Resuming with a discussion of the theme of the death of politics, specifically the discreditation of the political process and politicians as a psychological and political precondition for the rise of fascism, presenting itself as an outside force, the elimination of the political center that we have already, the strategy of which we have already seen successfully executed thus far in Italy with the, quote, democratic rebirth of Licio Gelli, Silvio Berlusconi, etc. We're going to turn to, in fact, we're going to repeat something that I did last week. In one of the last installments of Radio Free America, number 38, The Terror Connection, Part 3, we went into an article from the Atlantic Magazine's issue of January of 1993 called Colonel Dunlap's Coup. It concerned an essay by an active duty Air Force colonel named Charles J. Dunlap, Jr., called The Origins of the American Military Coup of 2012. This was an essay which won a prize in a Pentagon essay contest, and it concerns projections for the early part of the 21st century, which would obviously provide for an American military coup as the result of the outgrowth of political forces that can be seen to be operating in the early 1990s here in the United States. Obviously, this essay is fictional. However, as the article from the Atlantic of January of 1993 pointed out, it is something which is an altogether realistic scenario, and the seeds of which can be seen quite clearly today. I'm going to read an extract of The Origins of the American Military Coup of the Year 2012. Lieutenant Colonel Charles J. Dunlap, Jr., is described here as the Deputy Staff Judge Advocate, U.S. Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base, Florida. And we're going to read a section of his essay. I am calling my paper the, quote, Origins of the American Military Coup of the Year 2012, unquote. I think it's important to get the truth recorded. By the way, this is a fictional officer who is in prison awaiting execution for resisting the military coup headed up by a General Brutus. I am calling my paper the, quote, Origins of the American Military Coup of 2012, unquote. I think it's important to get the truth recorded before they rewrite history. If we're ever going to get our freedom back, we've got to understand how we got into this mess. People need to understand that the armed forces exist to support and defend government, not to be the government. Faced with intractable national problems on one hand and an energetic and capable military on the other, it can be all too seductive to start viewing the military as a cost-effective solution. We made a terrible mistake when we allowed the armed forces to be diverted from their original purpose. I found a box of my notes and clippings from our war college days, told my keepers I needed them to write the confession they want. It's amazing. Looking through those old papers made me realize that even back in 1992, we should have seen this coming. The seeds of this outrage were all there. We just didn't realize how they would grow. But isn't that always the way with things like this? Somebody once said that, quote, the true watersheds in human affairs are seldom spotted amid the tumult of headlines broadcast on the hour, unquote. And we had a lot of headlines back in the 90s to distract us. The economy was in the dumps. Crime was rising. Schools were deteriorating. Drug use was rampant. The environment was in trouble. And political scandals were occurring almost daily. Still, there was some good news, the end of the Cold War, as well as America's recent victory over Iraq. I would interject among the headlines in 1994, the alleged murder by O.J. Simpson. More about that later. All of this and more contributed to the situation in which we find ourselves today. A military that controls government, and one that, ironically, can't fight. It wasn't any single cause that led us to this point. Instead, it was a combination of several different developments, the beginnings of which were evident in 1992. Here's what I think happened. Americans became exasperated with democracy. We were disillusioned with the apparent inability of elected government to solve the nation's dilemmas. I.e. the discreditation of politics and politicians. Continuing. We were looking for someone or something that could produce workable answers. The one institution of government in which the people retained faith was the military. Buoyed by the military's obvious competence in the first Gulf War, the public increasingly turned to it for solutions to the country's problems. Americans called for an acceleration of trends begun in the 1980s, tasking the military with a variety of new, non-traditional missions, and vastly escalating its commitment to former ancillary duties. Though not obvious at the time, the cumulative effect of these new responsibilities was to incorporate the military into the political process to an unprecedented degree. These additional assignments also had the perverse effect of diverting focus and resources from the military's central mission of combat training and warfighting. Finally, organizational, political, and societal changes served to alter the American military's culture. Today's military is not the one we knew when we graduated from the War College. Let me explain how I came to these conclusions. In 1992, not very many people would have thought a military coup could ever happen here. Sure, there were eccentric conspiracy theorists who saw the Pentagon's hand in the assassination of President Kennedy, President Nixon's downfall, and similar events. But even the most avid believers had to admit that no outright military takeover had ever occurred before now. Heeding Washington's admonitions in his farewell address about the dangers of overgrown military establishments, Americans generally viewed their armed forces with a judicious mixture of respect and wariness. For over two centuries, that vigilance was rewarded, and most Americans came to consider the very notion of a military coup preposterous. Historian Andrew Janos captured the conventional view of the latter half of the 20th century in this clipping I saved. Quote, "A coup d'etat in the United States would be too fantastic to contemplate, not only because few would actually entertain the idea, but also because the bulk of the people are strongly attached to the prevailing political system and would rise in defense of a political leader even though they might not like him. The environment most hospitable to coups d'etat is one in which political apathy prevails as the dominant style," i.e., interjects Dave, "the death of politics." However, when Janos wrote that back in 1964, 61.9% of the electorate voted. Since then, voter participation has steadily declined. By 1988, only 50.1% of the eligible voters cast a ballot. Simple extrapolation of those numbers to last spring's referendum would have predicted almost exactly the turnout. It was precisely reversed from that of 1964. 61.9% of the electorate did not vote. America's societal malaise was readily apparent in 1992. 78% of Americans believed the country was on the, quote, wrong track, unquote. One researcher declared that social indicators were at their lowest level in 20 years and insisted, quote, something was coming loose in the social infrastructure, unquote. The nation was frustrated and angry about its problems. America wanted solutions, and democratically elected government wasn't providing them. The country suffered from a, quote, deep pessimism about politicians and government after years of broken promises, unquote. David Finkel observed in the Washington Post magazine that for most Americans, quote, the perception of government is that it has evolved from something that provides democracy's framework into something that provides obstacles, from something to celebrate into something to ignore, unquote. Likewise, politicians and their proposals seem stale and repetitive. Millions of voters gave up hope of finding answers. The, quote, environment of apathy, unquote, Janus characterized as a precursor to a coup, had arrived. And indeed, I think there's a very real possibility of, if not a precipitous military coup, a gradual military coup occurring. And in fact, I think these signs that are discussed by Colonel Dunlap in his fictional essay are indeed evident. Skipping ahead to 1994 to the San Jose Mercury News of today, Sunday, January 26th of 1994, New York Times article by Thomas Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, Dateline Baltimore, and headlined, Cities Embrace Third World Solutions. Quote, we have to let everybody know that we are not suggesting that our entire city has the same problems as a third world country. This concerns the involvement of a Federal Agency for International Development, used in the past as a front for various U.S. intelligence operations in the third world in order to help American inner city areas. The article reads in part, it is hard to know whether this is a good news story or a bad news story, but here it is. The Agency for International Development, which spent the Cold War fighting communism with foreign aid and helping poor countries like Bangladesh immunize children, has found a new customer for its services, America's inner cities. The good news is that AID has something to offer. The bad news is that parts of Los Angeles, Boston, and Baltimore now need it as much as Bangladesh. Over the years, AID developed a reputation in Washington as a bloated and ineffective bureaucracy. But the Clinton administration has been trying to shed what the agency did worst, supporting anti-communist dictators, and focus on what it did best, fostering cheap, low-tech methods for accelerating immunization, literacy, and agricultural development, and for nurturing small businesses. While AID's charter prohibits it from financing programs in the United States, nothing prevents the agency from sharing its expertise. Its shift in focus from Bangladesh to Baltimore was an accident waiting to happen. While talking last spring with Marion Wright Edelman, the longtime head of the Children's Defense Fund, about the health problems faced by American children, AIDS Director J. Brian Atwood was struck by the similarities with the problems his agency was fighting in Mali and Egypt, he recalled in an interview. Skipping down, an aide to Mayor Kurt Schmoke of Baltimore was watching, and the city immediately contacted Atwood and volunteered Baltimore for the first test case. Atwood, recognizing a new market for his agency's expertise, ordered aides to come up with a program eventually christened Lessons Without Borders, unquote. On June 6th, a team of the agency's senior health and development experts held a day-long seminar with their Baltimore counterparts at Morgan State University, discussing AID programs that had worked or, often just as important, had not worked. And again, I would note a trend which many other political observers have noted, the third worldization of the United States. I am afraid that in the event of an economic collapse, or perhaps even in the event, even in the absence of an economic collapse, the tactics that have long been utilized in the third world by our national security establishment will be utilized in the United States. Indeed, one of the lessons to be learned by, among other things, the assassinations of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and others, is that those tactics are indeed used at home just as they are used abroad. And indeed, I think the cities may be embracing a number of third world solutions, perhaps even final solutions. Note in that regard the statement that I cited earlier by Deborah Wright, the challenger to Representative Ron Dellums of Berkeley, in what I described as right-wing talk radio political recombinant DNA from the San Francisco Examiner of 625 of 94, Cain wife abusers, says candidate. This is Michael Fay meets O.J. Simpson meets Gloria Steinem meets Adolf Hitler. And I would note again in the rush of headlines that we have heard about, we are being told all about O.J. Simpson, and he is being held up as a political creature that we are to revile. And as I have noted in the past, the LAPD, or elements of it, are extremely politicized, particularly its intelligence units. And there are a number of serious evidentiary contradictions in the O.J. Simpson case. We don't have time to go into those this evening. However, I hold open the possibility, and it's just that, a possibility, of organized crime and or intelligence involvement with the O.J. Simpson case. Again, I'm not saying that is, I'm asking is it, because the O.J. Simpson case has actually proved to be a very profound political event, and I think it is massively destructive to relations between men and women, and is a discreditation of black Americans, one that could have profound psychological, sociological, and political implications in the past. I have also noted in the past, as documented in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, June 17th of 1994, that among the individuals from the past who've cropped up in connection with this case, former New York City medical examiner Michael Badden, the individual who endorsed the House Select endorsed the single bullet theory, the untenable single bullet theory for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I will discuss the O.J. Simpson case at greater length in the future. There are a number of strange things about it, not just the contradictions I cited earlier, but also the curious behavior of the media and of the LAPD releasing 911 tapes. They destroyed critical evidence in the Robert Kennedy investigation, assassination investigation, within a year of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the release of the 911 tapes is a very strange thing indeed. I will be discussing the O.J. Simpson case in the future. I simply note in this context the following article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, June 18th of 1994. Fallen Hero stirs complicated feelings among blacks. It's by Evelyn C. White, Chronicle staff writer. It reads in part, With a look of anguish sweeping across his face, Larry Miles lowered his head and took a few minutes to compose himself before speaking about O.J. Simpson. By the time he finished his thoughts, tears were glistening in his brown eyes. Quote, "I feel so sorry for him," unquote, said Miles, a 40-year-old San Francisco street vendor. "It seems like every brother who gets up there, a bad spirit finds a way to tear them down. You try to do good, and then bam, things fall apart," unquote. Well, among the possibilities I hold open in the O.J. Simpson case is that things may have been meant to fall apart. Recall again the principles of psychological warfare as enunciated by Sun Tzu and reiterated by Reinhard Galen. Among the possibilities I hold open with O.J. Simpson is that this may have been an arranged situation, sort of a three-dimensional Willie Horton case along the lines of the 1988 racist Republican election ploy. That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.